Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 162. I'm recording it on Sunday, August 30th, 2009. The peak 10 level today is 18. That's not horrible, but it's not great. The music for the podcast, the musical selection is entitled Bass Backfire. The title of the podcast is I Was Wrong. There is no equity risk premium. This is a follow-up. This podcast is a follow-up to the podcast I recorded yesterday, and if it would be helpful if you had listened to that one. It's not necessary. I'll review what's in it, but it would be helpful. That was podcast number 161, entitled The Time-Price Connection. And if you listen to that one, there were a couple interesting things going on. And early on, in the introduction to 161, I said, there's exciting stuff in this podcast coming up. I was clearly excited about it, and I was excited about it because I had read a thread at bogleheads.org, and I thought that a fellow there had asked a wonderful question, a wonderful basic question that we all need to know the answer to, and I felt that the answers that were given were not at all satisfying. I felt people were trying to answer the question sincerely, but the reality is we just don't know the answer today. And I felt that that was strange and troubling. It was a very basic question, and if we don't know the answer, we're in a lot of trouble. So I thought about it a little bit yesterday morning and came up at least partway to an answer and sort of scribbled some notes, and I thought I'd better record a podcast quickly because what happens sometimes is when I'm thinking these things through, if I don't record the podcast quickly, the ideas sort of leave your head. If you don't write them down or record them, they don't stick with you. Sort of like trying to remember a dream. If you have a dream and you don't write it down as soon as you wake up, it fades from your memory. Often within an hour, often for me within 5 minutes. If I don't write a dream down immediately, I lose it. So I wanted to record that podcast quickly, and I did so. And early on in the preface, I said, this is going to have some big stuff in it. This is going to have, you know, I just knew from the notes that I was close to hitting on some big stuff, but I wasn't quite there. And when the actual podcast, when I went through it, there were several points at which you can hear how unsure I am in my with my voice. I get close to saying something, and then I sort of pull back and I say, well, it's sort of like what they say in the passive model. I either didn't have the guts to say it, or I hadn't quite formulated the idea. It was a half-baked idea. And when I listened back, that was obvious to me, and I think now I've got a cleaner take on it, so I'm going to put that forward. And I considered the option of just re-recording the podcast, and that's probably the normal way to address something like this. If you get something wrong, part of the point of listening back is to see if you make some egregious error. Just re-record the thing. But I elected not to do that. I like, one of the things I love about discussion boards is that we have discussions in real time, and we have learning experiences in real time, and podcasts are not necessarily the same thing, but I like the idea. Part of the rational investing model is humility. It's a key principle, and part of humility is accepting that you can get things wrong, and so I think it's a good idea to record some podcasts that have in the title, I Was Wrong. I recorded one like that earlier. It was called I Was Wrong. The bull market began in 1975, not 1982. And that also came from a post at Bogleheads. I had always said for a long time that the bull market began in 1982. And many people say that. It's common. And this guy put up an argument saying, no, the bull market really began in 1975. And I checked the numbers, and he's absolutely right. And I thought that was just amazing. I don't know if you could, there's a good way to search it on Google, but if you search that, you would find thousands of people who are supposedly knowledgeable about stock investing who don't know when the bull market began. They're off by 7 years. There's reasons why they picked 1982, But the better date is 1975. And if you want to know why, go listen to that podcast. The better analysis, the better informed take is that the bull market began in 1975. So when I recorded that podcast, I liked that podcast a lot. And when I recorded it, I put right there in the title, I was wrong, as an exercise in humility, as a statement to the world that the rational investing model is going to be different than the passive investing model. It's not going to be a model where we try to cover up our mistakes. It's going to be a model where we almost take pride in our mistakes. Not that we're proud that we're dumb, but that we're proud that we're not defensive about getting things wrong, because the truth is, knowledge of stock investing today is primitive, so there's nothing to be ashamed of. John Bogle doesn't know it all. He endorsed passive investing, so if John Bogle can get it wrong, you know, Rob Bennett can get it wrong, for heaven's sakes. And let's not be ashamed, and let's take a little pride, not in getting it wrong, but take pride in our humility, you know, if that makes any sense. Take pride in our humility, that we're at least able to say we got it wrong. So I thought the better way to handle this is to do a follow-up on yesterday's podcast and start, you know, right in the title, say I was wrong. And now that I'm right, I think I can sharpen what I said, and I do think it's important. I do think that the insight here has potentially big ramifications. It goes to the model. It goes to how stock investing works. In practical terms, when I say what I'm going to say, you're not going to be bowled over, I don't think. You're going to hear it and say, yeah, well, so what? Who cares? It's theory you're talking about. Well, it is theory. But from theory comes implementation. All strategies derive from theory. And if you've got the theory wrong, all your strategies are wrong. And what happened with passive investing is they had a half-baked theory. They went with it. And unfortunately, what happened was they got good results, not because the theory was right or that the strategies were right, but just that stocks were due for a huge gain, you know, that would go over several decades. And when we had this huge gain, the passive investors took credit. They said, hey, look at this. Our theory really is great, isn't it? And everybody believed them, but it had nothing to do with passive investing. And now that the great bull market is over, passive investing is being seen as the disaster it always was, and that smart people should have been saying it was going all the way back to 1981, when Robert Shiller came out with his research showing that valuations affect long-term returns. But that's water over the bridge. But I don't want to make that same mistake in the development of the rational model, which is the alternative to the passive model. And so correcting the theory, getting the model right, really matters. Over time, it will change how we address all sorts of issues. So I think the thing to do is, right off the bat, get to the thing that was not stated clearly in the last podcast, 161. Now, that entire podcast dealt with a question asked at the Bogleheads.org board. And the question was, very intelligent question. And the guy said, look, and the guy was not at all critical of passive. He was trying to be a passive investor. He was trying to understand it so that he would know, you know, he'd have confidence in it and would know how to implement it. And he said, look, as I understand things, our belief is that the market, everything known about that affects the stock price is baked in to today's price. Now, this is core to the passive model. It's the reason why passives will tell you can't beat the market, timing doesn't work, all this sort of thing. Because all information is, quote unquote, baked in to the current price. And so the current price is essentially the best price anybody could come up with. They don't say it's perfect. They just say it's the best. Therefore, you can't beat it. No individual is smart enough to come up with a better price than what the market as a whole comes up with, because the market as a whole includes everything. Well, if that's true, it's not true, but if it were true, it would follow that one of the things baked into the price would be all future returns. In other words, Warren Buffett has said, the price of a stock is the discounted, or at least it should be, the stock of a price is the The price of a stock is the discounted value of all future dividend streams, all future income streams. So when the market, this so-called magical being, the market, sets this price, this efficient, rational price for stocks, and we're talking about the S&P index when we talk about stocks at passionsaving.com, when the market sets this price, it's not just looking at what stocks are worth today. It's looking at what stocks, what sort of income stream is going to be generated by stocks far into the future, many, many years into the future. It's looking at all that. It's looking at today. So the recession, for example, earnings are obviously going to be down during the recession, and that would cause, you know, that little information bit would cause the price to be a bit lower. But the recession is also going to come to an end. We don't know when, but the market has some idea when. Some people think 6 months. Some people think 6 years. It's all mixed in. All those information bits, all those opinions are factored in. And the market is supposedly the smartest entity, smarter than any individual. And after all those factors get considered, we have what we call the market price, which cannot be beaten. You can't outguess the market. The market's smarter than anyone. And well, the point this fellow was making is that price includes all future returns. Therefore, we know historically stocks have, you know, increased 6.5% a year on average, real. And all those future returns are factored in to today's price. They're already built in. So, what this fellow said, given that that's so, why would stock prices ever go up again? What would ever cause them to go up? If all the good news is baked in, what's ever going to cause them to go up? And the point I made in the podcast is this guy is being perfectly logical. There are circumstances in which the price could go up, but only if something totally unforeseen were to happen and it were good news. But of course, the odds of something, if it's totally unforeseen, it could be bad news as well as good news. And so, theoretically, stock prices should always remain the same, except for when totally unforeseen events happen, and those could cause either upward or downward motion. So, according to what this guy is saying, and it makes logical sense, people putting their money, their retirement money into stocks should accept no price, should not anticipate any price gain in the future, and possibly a price loss, and possibly a price gain, but they can't count on it. So, in the thread, several, you know, people treated him respectfully, and they tried to give good answers, but I wouldn't say the answers knocked my socks off. They were, you know, I personally think the answers were sort of lame. They were sincere, but they were not convincing. Well, I tried to give a convincing answer, but I stopped short of it because I never really answered the guy's question. And so now I want to do that. And then when I answered his question, it instantly jumped me to a new insight, which I think has broad ramifications. And I think when I said at the beginning of 161 that I thought this was going to be a big podcast, I was anticipating. My mind was sort of percolating on this insight, and I hadn't quite grasped it yet. So I recorded that podcast a day too soon, I'm afraid. All right. Why? If all future gains are baked in, then why is it that stock prices go up? If all future gains are already priced in today, when those gains take place, there shouldn't be any further price gains. So what's going on? Well, I think really what's going on here is we have a mistaken idea about price gains. And I've actually, part of the reason I think this was on my mind, I think the reason I jumped when I saw that thread is that this question of price gains and price losses, price changes, let's call them, has been on my mind a lot lately. I've recorded several podcasts. I had one not too long ago directly on point saying price drops are better than price gains. That's a shocking statement. I don't know the number for that podcast, but you can find it if you look through the the Robcast section of the site. I might be able to, if I look through some notes here, I might be able to pull it up. But that was a radical claim. Price drops are better than price gains, and I believe that that's true. I believe that that's true. So that was on my mind. And then, sort of as a result of that, I started working with John Walter Russell to develop a new calculator, the Buy and Hold Reality Checker, where we are going to attempt to demonstrate with numbers that price drops are better for investors than price gains. And there have been other podcasts that have tangentially made reference to this issue. So it's been on my mind. And I think what's going on, and the guy asked that question, implicit in his question is, he's saying, you know, why shouldn't we ever expect any price gains? Implicit in the question is a belief that price gains are good. What he's saying is, I'm not sure I want to invest in stocks if there aren't going to be any more price gains. So implicit in that is the idea that price gains are good. And I think he's wrong. I guess I need to tell you why, but I'll keep it brief because I have a whole podcast on it. The basic story is, we, almost all middle-class investors, we are both owners of stocks and sellers, buyers and sellers. We own stocks today. So usually a seller of an asset wants prices to be high. He wants to get as much as he can when he sells. A buyer wants prices to be low. He wants to get as good a deal as he can. So there's a natural antagonism between sellers and buyers regarding the issue of price. If you go into buy a used car, you'll see this. You want the car. The dealer wants to sell you the car. But there's an antagonism because you want the price to be as low as possible. He wants to be as high as possible. And you end up making all sorts of arguments. And you're making 20 arguments on why the price should be low. And he's making 20 on why it should be high. And the net effect is, in theory at least, and usually it's true in practice, you come up with a price that's somewhat reasonable. He buys half of your arguments, you buy half of his, and you get something in the middle. But there's a natural antagonism there. That natural antagonism does not exist in the stock market, and that's why the stock market is so kerplooey. That's why it doesn't work like any other market. I had another podcast on that topic, why the stock market does not set prices properly, even though other markets do. So this theme has been on my mind in the past month or two. Implicit in the fellow's question at bogleheads.org was the idea that price gains are good. And I am questioning that. So, see, what we're doing here is we're questioning the model for understanding how stock investing works. We're questioning the passive model, the dominant model, and even the most basic questions need to be reexamined. If you get those basics wrong, you're going to get it all wrong. It's a big problem. And what the passives did was they came up with some good ideas, then they jumped the gun. They assumed that they knew more than they did, and as a result, they made some huge mistakes. And those mistakes just grew over time because they've been unwilling to acknowledge them, reluctant to acknowledge them in some cases, and totally unwilling in other cases. And the mistakes keep growing and growing and growing year by year, and they never get fixed. So now we're in a pickle. Now we're in an economic crisis. But a very basic question is, is a price increase a good thing or a bad thing? Well, if you are a middle-class investor, they're a bad thing. Because if prices go up, the value of the stocks you've got in your drawer at home, or your safe deposit, you don't really have them in a drawer. Say you have them in a safe deposit box, or maybe you just have a piece of paper that tells you that you have a right to have these stocks. You may not physically own them. But the value of that asset goes up, but the value of the stocks you're going to buy next week in your 401k or next month or next year also, you know, goes up. The price goes up. So it's a net loss for you because if you're the average middle-class investor, you're going to be buying more stocks than you're going to be selling, at least, you know, in the foreseeable future. You're going to be buying every month for years to come, and you're not going to be selling until after you retire, maybe not at all. Some of us won't be selling at all. We'll just be passing our stocks on to our children. Some of us will sell. We'll need the money to live on. But you won't be selling until after you turn 65 in all likelihood. So price increases are a bad thing for you, not a good thing. They're a bad thing. You would be better off if prices stayed low so that you could buy those shares at low prices. Now, ultimately, you might want the price to go up after you retire. When you're getting ready to sell, you would like the price to go up, but you don't want the price to go up now. So it's a false idea that price increases are a good thing. So this guy's question, that false idea is implicit there. He's sort of complaining or lamenting the fact that prices there's that theoretically we should not see any further price increases. We should not expect any. The reality is, I believe, that what's really going on is that yes, stock prices do. We should expect future stock price increases. Even though they are built into the return today, the future price increases are considered by investors, and they are baked in, not to the return, to the price. They are considered by investors, and they are baked into today's price. I think he's right about that. I don't think they're necessarily baked in rationally or perfectly, but they are baked in. Investors are quite aware that stocks are going to provide, future price increases, and there's no question that that affects the current price. It's a little hard to think about. It's a little paradoxical. They're pricing that in. It's weird. They're pricing it in. They're pricing in that the price is going to go up. It's a strange little paradoxical thing, but it helps to spend some time thinking through what's going on, I think. It makes your understanding of stock investing more clear. So what's going on is these things are priced in to today's price. They are factored in to today's price. Let's just say that there were no bull markets, no bear markets. The price of stocks starting today started going up 6.5% a year, real. So the 6.5% real is priced in to today's price because it's a factor about stocks that people are aware of. So they bake it into the price. But when the price, when it actually it occurs, it becomes real. It becomes how can I say? I don't want to say it becomes reflected in the price. It becomes real. It happens. It's one thing for it to potentially happen, and it's a different thing for it to actually happen. And when it actually happens, it comes true on paper. It shows up. It's hard. It's hard to grasp. I'm not going to say that I have 100% firm grasp on this, but I think it needs to be aired. And if you have a sharper understanding, I hope you'll share your thoughts. It becomes real year by year. And so we do see that 6.5, even though it's baked in, we actually see it take place year by year. And it does show up. The way to think about it, though, is that when the puzzle here is how could it be baked in and yet still show up? If it was baked in, it should have showed up before. And the answer is, it's baked in. The reason you buy stocks is to get it. You want to get that 6.5. You wouldn't have paid the price in the first place if you weren't confident there was going to be that 6.5 return. So it was baked into your thinking. But it needs to take place in the real world in order for you not to be disgusted by stocks. In other words, it's not an extra. When you see that 6.5% gain in price, it's not a happy event. It's not like you say, "Oh, great, I got what was baked in." You expected it. So all the 6.5 is really doing is saying, "You've met expectations. Stocks have met expectations." If that, I hope that makes some sense. I'm going to listen back and see if I persuade myself. That's a tentative finding. Obviously, by the way I'm stating it, but I think that's right. I think it's right. I'm not sure. I think it's baked in. You wouldn't have bought stocks if you didn't expect that 6.5 gain. And when but it still has to occur. It's not, instead of thinking of the price gain as something good, which is what the questioner was thinking, the way to think about it is it's sort of a minimal requirement. It's not good and it's not bad. It's just what you expected. So it shows up on the books. The numbers go a little higher, but that's not a good thing. It's just an expected thing. It's sort of like the sun coming up each day. You know, the sun coming up each day, in one sense, of course, is a good thing. I'd rather it come up than not come up. But nobody writes a news story saying, hey, wonderful news, the sun came up today. It's baked into our understanding of what life is going to be tomorrow, that the sun's going to come up, and nobody's surprised, and it's not really good news. It's just neutral. It's essentially a neutral event. That's the way to think about it. A 6.5 gain real is a neutral event. 6.5% price increase. It's a neutral event. There's nothing happening of any note. I mean, it's happening in the sense that the potential is becoming real, but it's nothing to write home about. It's nothing to say, oh, yeah, stocks provided 6.5, great news. You already expected that. And not just you, everybody did. So there's nothing new, there's nothing good in it. 6.5 is just, that's what you paid for. That's what you put your money down for. You would not have given up use of your money unless you were getting a return, and the return you were expecting to get, if you understood stock history, was 6.5 real. And so that is baked in, but it still has to take place. Just because it's baked in doesn't mean it doesn't have to take place. That's where the questioner was a little off base. And certainly no criticism implied, because we all, obviously my understanding of this is not great, and I think it's fair to say John Bogle's isn't either, and most of the other experts out there. So that's what I think's going on. Now, you know, the point I did make in the earlier podcast, but it didn't really make sense, I don't feel, the way I said it, without making the point that I've made here, is that what he should have been asking about, what the questioner should have been saying is, should we expect future valuation increases? You see, when I say that a 6.5% price increase just means the sun's come up, there's nothing good or bad about it, it's a neutral event, a valuation change would not be a neutral event. So if valuations were 14 last year and they stayed 14 this year, you would get roughly a 6.5% real gain on your money, which is what you bargained for. Not a good event, not a bad event. It's neutral. It's what stockholders are supposed to get in the United States. It's just all the 6.5 is, remember, you have to know what the 6.5 is to understand this. The 6.5 is the earnings of the companies. When you buy a stock, you buy a share of the U.S. productivity. And that's what you're getting. That translates the share you have, whatever amount of dollars it is. If you put $100, you get 6.5 of 100 every year as your payment for giving up your money for that amount of time for that year. And if you put in 1,000, you get 6.5% of 1,000. Put 10,000, you get 6.5% of 10,000. Whatever it is, that's your payment for giving up control of your money for that amount of time. So there's nothing to get excited about. It's nice. It's a nice return, but it is baked in, and that's all it really is. It's the working of the U.S. economy. Now, if you had a valuation change, if you went from, say, 14 to 20, you would obviously get more than 6.5, and that's what you call a bull market. When it's more than 6.5, they start, you know, if it happens several years in a row, they call it a bull market, and that's where you get into trouble. Because the U.S. economy, what's baked into the price is 6.5. Well, when you start getting more than 6.5, you're getting more than was baked in. That isn't the sun coming up. That is something special. But the question is, what is it? What is this special thing? And the answer is, since it's not earnings, it's not anything real, it's not anything justified by the economic realities, what it is cotton candy nothingness. It's just empty air. It's vapor. It's nothing. So that's where you get into trouble, because that's going to disappear. That cotton candy nothingness is going to disappear. And so now you're in trouble. Because now what's going to happen is if you have, say, like we had in the 90s, 5 years in a row of returns of 20% or more, now you've got all these excess price gains built in that have to be vaporized. And when those are vaporized over the following 10 or 15 years, they're subtracting from your 6.5. You're getting the 6.5 because the economic growth is still taking place, but you're subtracting from it to pay for that bull market. And as a result, stocks become a horrible asset class for 10 or 15 years. And that's what we're living through today. Now, that's by my explanation of the guy's question that, or my response to the guy's question that he's right that the 6.5 is built in. However, that doesn't mean we shouldn't see gains of 6.5. We should still expect to see them. However, of course, you have to consider valuations. If the valuation level were always stable, we would always get 6.5. If we ever allow bull markets to develop, which of course we have in the past, then we will have a following period, a period following the bull market where the return will be less than 6.5 because we'll have to pay back for the bull market. And that's what we're living through today. But the guy, see how deep that question is. It's a simple, and he thought he was dumb. He says, oh, you know, it's a dumb question. It's not a dumb question at all. It's a deep question. It's an important question. And it's a question that the biggest name experts in the field don't know the answer to. Most of them. 90% of them, I believe. Now, when as soon as that hit me, you know, this was yesterday afternoon. I was listening back to the podcast, and it hit me that I had not answered that question clearly, and I better go back and do it. And as soon as it hit me in the head, you know, hit me that I said, you know, the real answer here is that the 6.5 is baked in, yet it still takes place. I thought back to that podcast I did called The Equity Risk Premium Explained at Last, perhaps. And I said, wait a minute, there is no equity risk premium. And I think this is true. And there's a lot of literature about the equity risk premium. And I think it's a misnomer. What they mean by equity risk premium is the theory on which passive investing is built says it's a theory rooted in the efficient market theory, and it's a theory rooted in a lot of rationalizations. The whole gist of the theory is that human beings are robots who always act in their self-interest. They don't have emotions. And this gets you in a lot of trouble because, of course, it's false. The underlying premise is false. Humans are really emotional creatures. Not entirely. We do have human reason, but we're not 100% rational. And so as a result, you get all kinds of crazy ideas when you start with that premise. And the idea of the rational model is to accept that we are emotional, and therefore, when you accept that you're emotional, your strategies can be rational, because it's rational to accept that we are emotional. Again, a paradox, but it's true. If you want to be a rational person, you have to accept that human beings are not entirely rational. You'll drive yourself crazy if you start trying to think we're rational, because the world will never comply with your understanding of it, because it's just false. So what the passive investing model says is it starts with an observation, and the observation is, of course, true. The observation is different asset classes, different things we can invest in, generate different returns. So for example, they say very safe asset classes might generate 3% real. In other words, TIPS or I-bonds or certificates of deposit, if you buy them intelligently, you might be able to lock in, not a money market account, but if you bought TIPS or I-bonds or CDs and you were willing to tie your money up for 5 years or something like that, and you went to the best bank, the bank offering the best rate, and you locked in when there were good returns, you might be able to get 3% real. Even that would be a bit of a push, but you might be able to get 3% real, I think. And that's what they call the risk-free rate of return. You're not putting your money at risk, you know, to any significant extent. You get 3% real. So they start with that, and then they say, well, look, bonds corporate bonds provide more than that. I don't know what the number is, but it's higher. And then they say stocks provide even more than corporate bonds. Stocks provide 6.5 real average long-term return. So they say, well, why, you know, the question that puzzled them for a while, they said, well, why do stocks provide more? You're giving up your money in both cases. In stocks, you know, these safe classes only provide, say, 3%. Stocks, it's 3.5. So stocks have a premium of 3.5% real per year. More than that, if you use a lower number, you know, for the safe asset classes, some people use a lower number. So it's at least 3.5 real, maybe more. And there's even a risk premium over bonds. I don't know what the number is for bonds, but the number for stocks is higher, significantly, several points higher. So the question is, why? Why? And the theory they came up with, and it's the dominant theory, it's accepted, it's conventional investing wisdom, is the reason why stocks provide more is that stocks are quote-unquote riskier. And what they mean by riskier, the way they measure it, is volatility. Prices go up and down more. Therefore, there are times when people don't have access to their money. It scares them. And a lot of people aren't willing to take on this scariness, this risk. And so they demand a higher return, or else they would not be willing to put their money in. So they say it's a premium that you get for being willing to take on the risk of stocks. This is the theory. And I don't think it's true. And I did an earlier podcast, The Equity Risk Premium Explained, where I tried to explain the question they've always had is that the equity risk premium is too big. It shouldn't be as big as it is. Why is it so big? And the earlier podcast tried to explain why it's so big. I accepted the premise that there's an equity risk premium. And then I said, well, why is it so big? And I said, the reason it's so big is most investors don't understand valuations. And if you don't understand valuations, you never actually realize that 6.5 return. What you do is you buy stocks at high prices, which is what most passive investors do, and you sell at low prices. Because you go with too high a stock allocation at times of out-of-control prices, and then your losses are so devastating, you have no choice but to sell. So you never realize the 6.5 real. You realize it for a certain number of years, but you don't hold it. And as a result, since we don't really get 6.5, we demand a high risk premium because we're not really getting it. Well, nice theory, Rob, but I've come to the conclusion it's BS. Now, again, I'm not gonna take down the podcast. I'm gonna let people listen to it, and then they can listen to this one, and they can say, "Look, you know, our hero, our guru, you know, is capable of putting out BS for a whole podcast," because that's healthy. I want people to see that. I want people to know that, because our knowledge of investing today is primitive. I'm as befuddled as everybody else. I'm trying to figure it out. You know, I think if you listen to that earlier podcast, you'll see I gave it an honest shot. I'm trying, you know, putting what little brain power God happened to bestow on me, which is not a whole bunch, and took a stab at it. But I think it is BS. And the reason it's BS is because I bought into a premise of the passive investing school that just doesn't stand up to scrutiny. The idea that there's some sort of equity risk premium, that investors are being compensated for taking on this risk, suggests that there's some sort of market negotiation going on. Now, we're all familiar with the idea of market negotiation. The reason we take to this idea is that it sounds plausible, it sounds right, because we all have dealt in the free market with situations where companies have to compensate us. They have to provide a premium to get us to buy their product. Take an example. The more competitive the industry is, probably the better. But say just the grocery stores. You know, they're pretty competitive. And they want you to shop at their store. And so, you know, the standard thing was they'd give what do they call them? Green stamps? Is that what they're called? I don't even know if they give them anymore. I think they still give them, but I don't know. But, you know, they give similar things now. They have these membership clubs. So if you go to Store X, you have to sign up, you know, for their program. And then every time you shop there, they take 5% off or whatever it happens to be. That's a premium. That's a, you know, shopper, you know, Store X shopper premium. It's just, and so what they're doing in the passive investing model is they're using that model, they're using that experience to explain why stock investors get higher returns. They're saying, well, there must be some kind of premium being paid. You know, it's a competitive marketplace. The different investment classes are all trying to justify themselves. And stocks have this problem that they're more volatile. And so the customers are sort of horrified. They're saying, you know, it's like going into a grocery store and they say, this grocery store doesn't have a very good seafood section. I don't want to shop here. It's dumb. I like seafood. What's going on? And you're ready to walk out and you say, whoa, I'm ready to walk out, but look at this. Look at this, Martha. They got a Store X Shoppers Premium. Wait a minute. Maybe that seafood's not so good after all. We can get our seafood somewhere else, but we should shop at this store because we get this premium. And what they're suggesting is that that's how the stock market works, that people are thinking, yeah, I've got to invest my money somewhere. Tips look good. I don't know. Bonds look good. Corporate bonds. But, whoa, look at this. Wait a minute. There's this premium on stocks. There's premium. Pay 6.5, and the bonds only pay 4. And that 6.5 better than 4. And yeah, I like that premium. They retire a lot earlier, all that kind of thing. Well, that's what they're suggesting. Now, is it true? I as soon as it hit me, the 6.5 thing, as I was thinking it through, it hit me. There's no premium. What's different with stocks is, where does that 6.5 come from? It's not like there's some store manager who says, let's make the stock return 6.5 because we got to entice shoppers of America to come here and buy our goods. It's not set by any human being. That 6.5, it's essentially the productivity of the US economy. The productivity of the US economy is sufficient to justify a 6.5% real return. And if the productivity of the US economy drops, the return on stocks is going to drop. No? And if the productivity of the US economy improves, the 6.5 number is going to go up. The 6.5 number isn't a number that applies every year. There are recessions when the U.S. economy is not even close to being good enough to provide a 6.5 real return. And there are other years when the productivity is so great, when we're steaming ahead, where the return could be much greater than 6.5. But the long-term productivity of the US economy is enough to justify 6.5. If I'm wrong about that, I hope some sharp economist will tell me where I'm wrong, because that's where it seems to me stock returns come from. What you own when you own a stock in the long term. What you own when you own a stock is a share of all the big companies, and the big companies are essentially reflecting the productivity of the US economy, and that's just being paid out to you. Well, the point here is they're not trying to entice you. It's not like the US economy is saying, hey, you know, we want to win over people who want to invest in tips and bonds. We want to win them over to stocks, so let's sweeten the pot a little bit. There's no sweetening the pot going on. There's no man or woman saying, you know, let's mark up the return for a while. We got to win some customers. It's objective. It's fixed. There's no human intervention here. And as far as I'm concerned, that means there's no risk premium. The idea of thinking that returns are set by trying to win over investors is, I mean, if what I'm saying here is true, it's knuckleheaded. That idea is knuckleheaded. It's not even rooted in reality. I'm not trying to make fun of the people who believed it because I obviously believed it myself. I did a whole podcast about the equity risk premium. So, you know, I'm certainly not mocking anybody or ridiculing anybody. I'm ridiculing an idea. I think now that I see through the idea, and perhaps I'm wrong about being wrong. If I'm wrong about being wrong, please tell me. Don't let me make a fool of myself even more than I already have. But I don't, as of today, I don't see it. There's no man up in the sky saying, yeah, we got to win over some of the shoppers that are buying bonds. We got to get them into stocks. There's nobody raising the return on stocks. The return on stocks is fixed. It's fixed by the productivity of the U.S. economy. It has nothing to do with anybody. So there's no such thing as a risk premium. The 6.5 is essentially fixed. It's the only thing that can change it is a change in the U.S. economy. And we obviously can't control that. We want the economy to be as productive as it can be. And we do all that we can to make it as productive as it can be. And all our efforts have resulted in a 6.5% real return for many years now. So it's probably going to be something in that neighborhood in the future. Long term, not next year, but long term. There's going to be recessions like we're going through now. There's going to be recoveries like we're likely to see in a few years. And they're going to balance out to 6.5 or something in that general neighborhood. And there's no risk premium to it. There's no market dickering going on. That's just the number. So what that suggests is that there is no equity risk premium. So first of all, you know, nix that earlier podcast and nix all the literature that discusses this. But as I say, the practical implications are not obvious. A lot of practical people are going to say, you know, Rob, why do I care? You know, regardless of whether there's a equity risk premium or not, the return is still 6.5. So what difference does it make? Well, it does make a difference because that whole idea, that whole way of thinking that there's a risk premium, it leads you to believe other things about stocks. It leads you to start thinking that stock market behavior is this rational thing. It's human beings trying to maximize their personal benefit. That's what's going on. And I don't think that's what's going on. It's just the whole model is wrongheaded. The 6.5 has nothing to do with people trying to maximize anything. It's just the 6.5 is like a mountain or an ocean. It just exists. It just is. It's a fact of life. It's a reality to deal with, to cope with. It has nothing to do with any dickering. And that suggests that there's a lot of other things that the passive model has attributed to dickering really are not caused by dickering. They're caused by totally different sorts of phenomena. And in many cases, emotion rather than dickering. But what we're saying here is there might be it. Now, it is certainly true. The other asset classes are generally fixed by human beings. So, for example, when bond returns are paid, those are set by the company. The company says, we're going to issue bonds. And here's the return we're going to specify. And it's written there on the bond when they're issued. So in that case, there is a human being setting the return. So in that case, this idea of market dickering does apply. So it could be that instead of there being an equity risk premium, there's a non-equity risk penalty. That could be. So for example, it could be that everyone knows that the return on stocks is 6.5 and there's nothing we can do about it. It's a fact of life. And when somebody issues bonds, they say, well, the risk on stocks is more than bonds, more volatility, more risk. So I'm not going to give 6.5. You know, I'm going to give something less. That could be. We don't know that that's so, but it's a theory. You know, it's a theory that might hold up. One of the big problems you have with passive investing is people come up with these theories and they're not proven. They can't be proven. They're all just, you know, it's all just classroom stuff. And they assume it, and then the stock selling industry, you know, starts marketing it, and it all of a sudden it becomes, you know, wisdom that may not be questioned. It's all artificial. And this goes on hundreds of different questions. It's a big, big problem in this field. That there are all sorts of things we believe that are just not so. Because some academic who was smart enough came up with a smart theory, but the theory just happens to be wrong. But the stock selling industry has spent millions of dollars promoting this theory and it doesn't want to admit that it's wrong. And, you know, middle class investors are told to invest in such and such a way, not because it's a good way to invest, but just because this is what they've spent millions of dollars marketing. And now they don't want to admit they were wrong. I think that's a problem. But there could be a non-equity risk penalty. In other words, bond prices, it could be that bond prices are set relative to stock prices and they're deliberately set lower. I'm not saying that's true. I'm saying it's possible. And the same thing could be with certificates of deposit and so forth. But there can't, as far as I can tell, there can't be an equity risk premium because the equity return is set, not by people. It's not set as part of a market dickering process. Now, I just want to explore a couple more issues because all these issues are connected. And I've been sort of exploring them all in a number of podcasts. So as you get a new piece of the puzzle, it helps other things to click into place. So one of the questions I had another podcast on not too long ago was a question that was asked by the guy who writes the Bad Money Advice blog. Frank Curmudgeon is the screen name he uses, not a real name. But Frank asked me one time, and this was at the Money and Such blog, he said, Rob, you're saying that stock prices are not predictable in the short term. You're saying short-term timing doesn't work. You're saying stock prices are predictable in the long term. Long-term timing does work. How does the market know when we transition from the short term to the long term? How the heck does the market know this? And I think that's a very intelligent question. And I gave, I think it was four different answers. And they were all somewhat satisfactory to me, but none was entirely satisfactory. So the question still gnaws at me. And I think I have a better answer to that. See, I do this all and it's like dominoes falling. I come up with one thing where I think I've answered, and then it leads me to, it clicks a piece of the puzzle into place on another question that I struggled with a year ago, and then that clicks a piece on some question I struggled with 3 years ago, and over time, you fill in all the missing spaces. I think the answer is, now that I feel I know that there's no equity risk premium, there's no market dickering, the long-term return on stocks is set. There's no market dickering. It's just a fact of nature. It's U.S. productivity that determines that number. So then the question is, okay, if U.S. productivity determines that number, well, why are returns sometimes so much higher than that? Well, you know the answer to that one. It's emotion. Now, what human emotion is it that makes prices sometimes go so much higher than 6.5? In other words, in a rational world, I said this in the 161, the earlier podcast, in a rational world, stocks should just return 6.5 every year. This is the ideal we should be working towards. A world in which stocks return 6.5 every year like clockwork. And there's no reason they can't do that. You see, this is the practical implication of rejection of the risk premium. If you think that the six, and I used to buy into this, I fell for this, so I'm not mocking people, but if you think that the reason you get 6.5 in stocks is the risk premium, is because the volatility, then if you take away the volatility, which is what rational investing would do, if investors were warned about the dangers of overvaluation, there would no longer be huge bull markets, and then there will no longer be huge bear markets. The return would just be 6.5 every year. Well, if you think that 6.5 is the result of an equity risk premium, then take away the volatility and you take away the return. That would mean the return of stocks would drop down to, 3 or 4% real. And I said that in an article at my site. I'm not going to take the article down. Maybe I'm not going to take the article down. Possibly at some point I'll put up a addendum, but I think for now I'm just going to leave it and add additional articles and additional podcasts that give a better informed take. Because I see this site as an exploratory, a learning site. I'm not going to act like I always knew it. I just think that's phony. But, and it's dated, I say in there, it's an article of a particular date, and I believe that as of that date, and at this later date, I believe something different. But if you stop believing that the price is set by market dickering, then the 6.5, you don't have to give that up. If we had a stable 6.5, you don't have to give up one penny of return if that return is set by an objective fact, by U.S. productivity. Well, that's great news. That means if we can educate the American public about how stock investing really works, we can all earn 6.5% real by investing in stocks and not have to deal with volatility, which means not having to deal with risk. We can take away the risk of stocks and preserve the return. So says Rob Bennett. If I'm wrong, please tell me where I'm wrong. Don't let me make more of a fool of myself than I already have, but I don't think I'm wrong. I'm not sure. I'm not dogmatic, but I don't think I'm wrong. If we could educate people, and I have a 4-series podcast on what we need to do, the future of investing, it's called, what we need to do to stabilize that return. I devoted 4 hours to it. If we took those steps, and the simplest one would be every time we report what the Dow is or what the S&P is, we also report what the P10 level is so that people know when they buy stocks at 3x fair value that they are going to be crashing soon. So that they know the risk of stocks at that point in time is much greater than it would be if the P10 level were reasonable. Just took that one step, we would stabilize stock returns to a huge degree. And if we did that, I used to think that if we stabilized returns, because I believed in the equity risk premium, I used to think it would mean that returns would drop, say maybe to 4% or something like that. But no, I don't believe that today. They would stay 6.5. It would be all gain, no loss. It would just be stability. We would eliminate these economic crises. Every one of the 4 economic crises we've suffered since 1900, has been preceded by an error in which large numbers of investors came to believe that price didn't matter. Passive investing has been the cause of every economic crisis we have suffered in the last century into this one. And we can do away with that by stabilizing stock valuation levels at 6.5 real. Very nice return, but no need for all this crazy up and down stuff. We can stabilize it by teaching people to use tools like the stock return predictor. That would do it. Well, that's why I started out podcast number 161 saying this is going to be exciting stuff. It's really funny. It goes to how humans learn. I find it very fascinating. But I didn't even know what I was going to say. I knew I was close. It was on the tip of my tongue. But I wasn't even able to verbalize it in that podcast. It took me another day. It took me listening back to a podcast in which I skirted around the issue but didn't nail it. And now I feel I'm able to say it more clearly. Well, I'm going to take it one more step, and then I'll let it be. I mentioned at the beginning of podcast number 161, I said, this is one of these podcasts I like where we address basic questions. And I said, the quintessential podcast where I do that is one that I did early on, where I say, when stock prices crash, where does all the money go? It makes me laugh every time I hear that question. It's such a wonderful question. Where does all the money go? We lost $9 trillion in that stock crash last year. $9 trillion. Where did it go? Everybody blames the bankers. Did the bankers put it in suitcases and run away to Rio? What the heck happened to the $9 trillion? Somebody tell me, please. Nobody will answer that question. And the answer I gave is it went poof. When $9 trillion disappears in a stock crash, all it is nothingness. Any price, any stock price at above the price needed for a P10 level of 14 is cotton candy, nothingness. It's inevitable it's going to disappear in reversion to the mean. John Bogle's the one who taught me about reversion to the mean. God bless him. So it's inevitable it's going to disappear. And when it disappears, it doesn't go to Rio, doesn't go in somebody's suitcase. It just goes poof. So when I started talking, you know, when I started writing notes for this podcast, then I said, okay, the 6.5 is like a mountain or an ocean. It's not determined through market dickering. It's just out there. It's just a reality, an objective reality, not set by any human. The question that brought to my mind is, okay, I've answered the question. When stock prices crash, where does the money go? It goes poof. How about flipping it around? When stock prices boom, where does the money come from? Isn't that a good question? We lost $9 trillion last year. It all went poof. Well, in January of 2000, we were 3x fair value. P10 level was 44, not 14. That was more than $9 trillion because we lost $9 trillion in the crash, roughly, we lost about $3 trillion from 2000 through 2008 before the crash. So in 2000, it was overvalued by about $12 trillion in today's dollars. $12 trillion. So where the heck did the $12 trillion come from? Where the heck did where did it come from? The answer is, you know, it's the reverse of the poof answer. It's, you know, we poofed it into existence. We waved our little magic wand of investor fantasies and we poofed it into existence. You know, I see this on Lost in Space. My kids make me watch this show. It's not my favorite. And over and over again, they have bad guys show up and they just have this little music in the background that goes blink. And the person shows up, you know, and they never explain how they got these powers. It's just, you know, it's part of the show. But, you know, it sort of makes it easy, you know, to write plots because anybody can appear or disappear at any given moment. The money just popped into existence. Now, people are going to say, how could that? It scares people. You see, this is one of the problems we have with rational investing. Rational investing is scary because what we're doing is we're talking about money, which we like to think of as the hard stuff. We like to think, oh, we're very serious people when we're dealing with money. You know, we might goof around at baseball games and we goof around when we come up with names for rock groups. But when it comes to money, you know, you got to wear a three-piece suit and, you know, have a serious expression on your face. Comb your hair properly. Not record podcasts in your pajamas, for heaven's sakes. But the reality is, we're more serious when we're naming rock groups than we are when we're talking about stock investing, in Rob Bennett's opinion. The whole field is a big joke, not because we want it to be a big joke. We want it to be serious, but we take ourselves so seriously that we can't admit mistakes, which means we make ourselves dumb. We deliberately dumbify ourselves. So, the $12 trillion that was in existence in January 2000, it didn't exist. It was cotton candy. It was just, what happened is, essentially, it showed up on your portfolio statement. There was no reality to it. All you need to do to understand this is think, how do stock prices increase? There doesn't have to be any economic thing that causes it. People just say, hey, I'll bid 50 for that stock. No, I'll bid 60. No, I'll bid 80. No, I'll bid 120. And it goes up, 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 up. And the newspaper shows 120 as the price the next day. And if you go to your whatever it is, you know, wherever you have your stocks, and you say, I want the 120. Give me cash. They will give it to you. It's a fact. They will give it to you. So there are two emotions driving the train. One, we're always going to have bull markets unless we start preaching rational investing, and we need to preach it hard. We need to preach it daily. We need to have it on television advertisements. We need to have politicians talking about it. We need to have it in books, and we need to have it in Money Magazine. If we don't preach rational investing and preach it every bit as hard as we have preached passive, the emotional approach, for 30 years now, it's not going to take. But if we preach it, I think we can connect with people, I believe. Because stock investing works like everything else. The price affects the value proposition, and that's the way it works with cars and comic books and bananas. And so I don't think it's that hard a message if you didn't have people talking about passive investing all the time, which throws people off and confuses people. We have the power to make the stock price whatever we want it to be. It's a dangerous power to possess. I wish we didn't possess it, but we do. And because we have that power, you know, we could sit around with a, you know, I don't know if the value of stocks was $12 trillion, it was $12 trillion too high, and it was 3 times fair value. If I do the math, I'll mess it up for sure. That would make me think that the correct value was $4 trillion. John Walter Russell, call your office. Tell Rob what he got wrong. The value wasn't $12 trillion. It was $12 trillion too high. So that math doesn't work. But it was $12 trillion too high. I don't know what the right number was. Whatever, $12 trillion too high, it was $12 trillion more than it should have been. But the point is, this is in 2000, January 2000, and I'm using today's dollars. So the point is, was $12 trillion too high? What we essentially did was we said, hey, let's vote ourselves a raise. We did this collectively. We never sat down and planned it. It wasn't a conspiracy. But we all sort of noticed that, hey, if we bid stock prices up, there's no penalty. It shows up in our account, and they let us spend the money. It's like so groovy. It couldn't be better. Well, humans are always going to go for that. You know, unless you teach them that there's a penalty, and that's what the stock return predictor does. The stock return predictor reveals to you what the penalty is for marking prices up too high. But unless you do that, everyone's going to bid them up. So what happened is we bid them up to this insane level. Now, the question we should be asking ourselves is, if we have the freedom to bid stocks up to whatever we want, why don't we bid them up to 10 times fair value, 20 times, 50 times, 100 times? Why don't we just keep going with it? Then we can all retire at age 22. Why not? The answer is there's a countervailing emotion that goes in the other direction, and that is, I call it the reality principle. The reality principle, in the back of our minds, we all have it. We might pretend that we believe in passive investing, but none of us really do. We all know in the back of our minds that the reality principle is still out there messing up the deal. We all know this. I had a podcast on this. I called it Common Sense is the Problem. In other words, if it weren't for common sense, we could just, you know, of course, the title is a joke. It's not really the problem. But if it weren't for common sense, we could just keep bidding stock prices up to 10 times fair value, and we could all retire at age 22 and have no troubles. But the reality, of course, is even when we are telling ourselves we believe in passive investing, fantasy world stuff, we know somewhere in our consciousness that, no, that's not really the way it works. And we're thinking on some level of consciousness, wait a minute. I like this passive investing stuff. I like get rich quick. I like money for nothing. But what happens if all my friends and neighbors, you know, the smart thing to do, I know prices are going to crash. They're 3 times fair value. My common sense tells me there's going to be a vicious crash. And if I ever looked at the historical data, it would confirm it. It tells me there's going to be a crash. But, you know, if I get my money out before the crash, they'll give me the money, right? Then they will. It's true. So the worst thing you can do is wait until all your neighbors take their money out, and then you're stuck with the, you know, you're stuck paying the price. So we've got two emotions. One emotion, the bull market emotion, is let's vote ourselves a raise. And that took the P10 level from 8, which it was in 1982, up to 44, January 2000. Then we've got this other emotion called, I want to get out before all my friends and neighbors get out. I don't want to lose it all. And that emotion took it from 44 in January of 2000 down to 18, the last day of August 2009. But there are a lot of people out there today who are still thinking it's, you know, they still want to get out before their neighbors. They still have that, they don't know that most people don't know that the average P10 is 14. See, we haven't educated people on the subject. So all they know is they saw lots of people getting out last year, and they're sort of bummed that they didn't. And when we go from 18, and we will, well, I don't want to say we will for sure, but I think the odds are, we'll probably go from 18 down to 16 or 15. And a lot of people are going to freak, and they're going to say, whoa, we're going down to 12 soon like we were back in February or March. I'm getting out, you know, and that's going to push it down to 12. And then when it goes down to 12, a bunch of other people are going to say, yeah, it stopped at 12 last time, but I got a feeling this time it's going down to 8, and that's going to push it down to 8. Emotional extremes in one direction cause emotional extremes in the other direction. So that's how the market knows the long term. The market, there's no date at which there's a bell that rings that says, hey, we're going to stop taking it down. But what's going on in the market is a contest of emotions. And that battle's being fought every day. And the rational model says, why don't we call the whole thing off? There's no loss if we encourage everyone to invest rationally, which means to go with a lower stock allocation when the valuation level is high and a higher stock allocation when the valuation is low. And if we all did that, look what would happen. Prices would self-regulate. We would always be at a P10 level of roughly 14 or 15, maybe 16, maybe 13, but never 20 and never 10. And I think that would be just great. We would all get 6.5% returns a year, which is a great return. We'd give up those insane bull markets of the 90s, but we'd also give up the insane bear markets of the 2000s, and I don't think we've seen the worst of it yet. And, of course, we'd be able to plan our financial futures far, far better than we're able to plan them today because we would know how much we have. And we would, I don't think we would eliminate all economic crises, but we would sure put a dent in them.